Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that made his treatment of it so successful is that it's this shadow that is everywhere, but it never kind of takes over the story in a sense. It's there, like hovering over every page, and it's driving his characters on a kind of emotional and practical level. But it's never the center of the story. That in and of itself is just kind of an amazing feat of writing, but it's also just very effective, I think.
Can I ask, were you a comic book lover as a kid?
I was, but I kind of came to them a little bit late for some reason. But I did love comic books. I had a good spell where I was very into comic books. Yeah.
Mine were very English. They didn't seem to have this sort of romance and drama of sort of superhero comics. They were in some ways quite mundane and took place in rather suburban places in England. So I really came to this as a kind of education.
Yeah, in the context of like American history, which is sort of how they have to be seen. I mean, Superman was a creation of like a very particular moment in American and world history. And he was a guy who fled, who fled his planet, which exploded and could only be kind of harmed by a piece of his own planet. As a kid, you just get caught up in the story of Superman, but you have the opportunity to think about the kind of actual historical context for his creation, which is what Cavalier and Clay do with their own superhero. It's about escape. It's so resonant. Yeah.
Of course, when the book is set, New York was a sort of beacon for waves of immigrants. It would have been a city dense with languages, people who had just arrived from somewhere else, really kind of poised between the world they'd come from and the new world that they were in, between sort of the trauma of whatever they were leaving or escaping and possibility of the future. I wonder how much that duality still defines New York, the sense of people building something over the kind of ruins of something lost.
Yeah, that's a great thing to ponder. I mean, I think one of the issues that New York is dealing with right now is, I feel like it's because the city has become so unaffordable. It has in many ways kind of not entirely lost, but it has at least lost some of that sort of transformative possibility. The promise of New York is you can reinvent yourself here. You can build a new future for yourself here. There's everything. New York is possibility, or at least was. And I think now it's New York is it's always been a hard place to live. It's not like it was. You would come here and everything would magically happen. You would come here and you would struggle and scrap and live in a squalid tenement. But you would, if you kind of you had the right kind of ambition and work ethic and creativity, you could kind of make opportunities for yourself. And that's very much the New York of Cavalier and Clay, at least for those Jews who were able to escape. And I think increasingly it's not New York any longer because the city's just become so expensive to live in. And it's become so difficult for people who don't come here with money, who don't begin here with money. And that more than anything is what is driving Mamdani's popularity, and I think what is driving this sort of sense that New York needs to change.
I wonder if you see parallels at all between someone like Koch, who, as you mentioned in your book, is the son of immigrants. His father arrived in 1909, was processed through Ellis Island, mother too. They worked in the garment industry. He rose to become, this formidable mayor of New York. And the story that is told of Cavalier, who also sort of rises, but not just of Cavalier, but a whole kind of Jewish world of self-made invention and success.
Yeah.
Does Koch belong to the world of Cavalier and Clay?
I mean, in some ways he does. I mean, I think he's a different sort of product of New York. He's more a product of the kind of civic culture of New York. I mean, he's someone who is invested in local politics in Greenwich Village. The GI Bill pays for him to go to law school, and he goes to NYU Law School. And you know, he becomes involved in this effort to allow folk singers to play music in Washington Square Park, which was weirdly a kind of a controversial issue back in the 1950s and early 60s. But he is very much someone who rises from very kind of modest means in New York, I mean, barely modest means at a certain point, to becoming the most sort of powerful person in the city. So he is also in a similar vein, someone who's, you know, who only could have been kind of created by New York.
Jonathan, let's hear an excerpt now from The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay by Michael Chabon, read by David Colacci.
The long run of Cavalier and Clay and the true history of the escapists' birth began in 1939, toward the end of October, on the night that Sammy's mother burst into his bedroom, applied the ring and iron knuckles of her left hand to the side of his cranium, and told him to move over and make room in the bed for his cousin from Prague. Sammy sat up, heart pounding in the hinges of his jaw. In the livid light of the fluorescent tube over the kitchen sink, he made out a slender young man of about his own age, slumped like a question mark against the doorframe, a disheveled pile of newspapers pinned under one arm, the other thrown as if in shame across his face. "This," Mrs. Clayman said, giving Sammy a helpful shove toward the wall, "was Joseph Cavalier, his brother Emil's son, who had arrived in New York tonight on a Greyhound bus all the way from San Francisco." "What's the matter with him?" Sammy said. He slid over until his shoulders touched cold plaster. He was careful to take both of the pillows with him.
"Is he sick?"
"What do you think?" said his mother, slapping now at the vacated expanse of bedsheet, as if to scatter any offending particles of himself that Sammy might have left behind.
And that was an excerpt of The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay by Michael Chabon. It was read there by David Colacci. You're listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin, and my guest is the author and journalist, Jonathan Mahler. Jonathan, I was wondering, as someone who, you know, has written this big book, The Gods of New York, reading Cavalier and Clay, you know, how do you as a writer keep nostalgia from turning into just myth-making?
Yeah. Well, I had the advantage of revisiting a period of time filled with ugly incidents. So that helped. I do think with New York in particular, there's always this impulse to look back on kind of these seemingly like better times. I guess it's like for me it's so what I really try to do in my books, this book and Ladies and Gentlemen of the Bronx is Burning also, was use the periodicals from that period, the newspapers, the magazines, to like really immerse myself in them in a way that allows me to kind of recreate what the city felt like in that moment. That I think is like a way to strip away some of, you know, to kind of take off the whatever the rose-tinted glasses that you might be tempted to put on when you're kind of casting your gaze back at an earlier era. And in that sense, it's sort of like, you know, it's what novelists like, you know, Michael Chabon do so well, which is just to try to recreate a moment as it felt in that moment, and not do it kind of, you know, retrospectively.
Jonathan, we don't have a lot of time, but I want to just quickly mention another piece that you recommended to me. Of course, we could have easily talked about Tom Wolfe's novel Bonfire of the Vanities, which captures the New York that you write about in The Gods of New York. But you instead directed me to a wonderful essay by Wolfe called The Billion-Footed Beast. It's sort of a manifesto, really, against what he saw as the sort of miniaturists of American fiction. He wanted big epics, a bit like Cavalier and Clay, and frankly, a bit like The Gods of New York. He basically was saying novelists had sort of lost interest at that moment in trying to capture the full scale of modern life. A, do you think he was right? And B, did he achieve that with Bonfire of the Vanities?
Yeah, I thought it would be fun to talk at least briefly about that because of, you know, in many ways, I sort of shorthand for the Gods of New York is that it's the nonfiction Bonfire of the Vanities. Having said that, I, of course, went back and reread Bonfire several times, and it's actually a very flawed book. Wolf was a brilliant writer. I mean, the book just rips along, but the characters are not super complicated. It's frankly a little bit racist. There's a lot of kind of, you know, stereotyping. But I found that essay so interesting because he was intending to be provocative in that essay, and I think he succeeded. But I did admire about it was this idea that it's the job of a novelist, or I don't know if it's exactly their job, but it's a job of the novelist to go big. I mean, as like Michael Chabon does, to be ambitious, to try to sort of say something more than you can say with almost any other medium. You know, you're creating a world, and that world is kind of reflecting or in some ways refracting reality. And I think that resonated for me, this idea that, you know, try to write big books, big ambitious books that say something new and powerful about the moment you're living in. I mean, that's sort of, I guess, to some extent, what I try to do with nonfiction, too. But I feel like it's the great calling of novelists. Yeah.
Well, if you want a rigorous nonfiction version of the Bonfire of the Vanities, albeit with a literary propulsion, The Gods of New York is for you. It's by my guest, Jonathan Marler. Jonathan, this has been great. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Aaron. It was a pleasure.
We've been talking about The Gods of New York by Jonathan Marler, published by Random House, and The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay by Michael Chabon, also published by Random House. My thanks, as always, to my producer, Ilya Maritz, and to sound engineer and composer, Tim Wood. Shelf Life is a production of One Grand Books in association with Grand Journal and Radio Catskill. If you like the show, you can find plenty more episodes on Spotify and Apple with guests including Jeanette Winterson, Helen Phillips, Michael Cunningham, and Ari Shapiro. While you're there, please give us a 5-star rating to help others find the show.
Sullivan County's social host law, Jared's Law, makes it illegal for anyone 18 or older to provide alcohol or cannabis to minors. Named for a local teen killed in a drunk driving accident, Jared's Law ensures that adults are held accountable, with penalties including fines and even jail time. Parents and guardians are still the number one deterrent to underage substance use, and Jared's Law helps keep our kids safe. Paid for by Catholic Charities.
For 45 years, the male vocal ensemble Chanticleer has been one of the shining stars of the choral firmament. To help us celebrate this holiday season, Chanticleer comes to share music from the time of the English Renaissance to today. Join us for a special hour of incredible musical harmony with Chanticleer.
Coming up tonight at 9 on Radio Catskill.